the three questions. Jamila Rose, is your question for now? I didn't know if you want the answer only to yourself or I should speak now. Okay, I'll speak now. Regarding, I may share your question. Yes. It's been 9 years since my mom passed to the next life. During her transition, I lay with her. She breathed out. I breathed in and on and on. I look in the mirror and see her, not me. I've been thinking that I may have taken on bits of her. Could I have? If so, can you recommend a remedy? It's true we all live in one another, and especially the ones whom we especially love live deeply in us. But sometimes the way that we live in one another is such that there is constraint in it, as though tangled up together. So how to be together in this world and in the hereafter, but freely? Speaking about concentration speaks about the great significance of returning again and again to an image, a theme, so that it intensifies and becomes strong and creates it in one's mind. But by the same token, returning again and again to something without willing it means that one's will becomes limited, one's freedom becomes limited. And relationships are most strong when there's mutual freedom. Love is at its most perfect when one isn't constrained. So how to liberate your spirit so that you can remain forever close and yet in a manner that is free. Moshe speaks of this in the instructions for the funeral prayer, the universal worship, and in the burial sermon. Do not call back the one who is passing on. The poem we read, Isabel's Child, that theme was there also. That each soul has his or her journey to make. And while we are companions, ultimately each soul's destiny is its own. With respect to one's children, for instance, one cannot live their life for them. They have to find their way. One is a parent, and yet in another sense, that soul is all its own. It doesn't belong to you. So there's an affinity, there's a bond of love, and at the same time, the true parent, the true basis of all lives is the one life. So one could go to the place of memory of one's loved one, whether the resting place or another place connected with the memory of one's loved one, and go there and say prayers, bring flowers, burn incense, and communicate something, communicate an intention, communicate the nature of the relationship you envision now, letting her go on, a farewell for this phase, the anticipation of a joyful meeting in the hereafter, but a full affirmation of the uniqueness of her journey onward and the uniqueness of your own further journey on earth. A loving, respectful, earthly farewell at the place of memory amidst prayer and flowers and incense. There's a question about things to watch for after the retreat. Coming back, going back home, going back to jobs, you might find that the transition feels very bumpy. So take good care. Avoid rushing into a lot of outer activity. Pace yourself in as much as you can. You probably have some responsibilities that will commence immediately. But in as much as you can, still hold back a bit. Don't just throw yourself out there in the middle of the world. Gradually re-emerge into conversations and interactions. Let yourself have some days to be less talkative. And you might find, even over time, you just become a bit less talkative overall. And, you know, observe the effect of things on you, and those things that serve as buffers, well, utilize them. Like stepping out into the fresh air, or even opening the window, standing under a tree. Little things that you can return to again and again in the course of your day. The thought of Murshid. Fanafi Sheikh, Fanafi Rasul, Fanafi Allah. And, you know, there are three principles that are very valuable. I repeat them so often. Hoshdar Dam, keep coming back to your breath. Nazar Bar Qadam, feel your feet on the ground with every step. And Khilvat Dar Anjuman, even though you're in the Anjuman, you're in the crowd, still preserve this solitude. Feel as though you, in some sense, the retreat continues and extends out, even into your workplace and home, carry it with you. And especially, we've been doing practices all day, and you have a daily practice, I'm sure. So I encourage you to use this chance to rededicate yourself to that practice. And you may, as I mentioned, take practices that we've done into your daily practice with the consultation of your guide. So you can feel that these sessions that we've been having of communion and exaltation and remembrance, it will continue cycling through your days, morning after morning. This has been a tryst, an encounter with the Holy One, and you can make an assignation every morning. Be sure to meet the Holy Spirit and the angels and the familiar jinn and all the beings who will join you in that consecrated acts when it is done at the same time, at the same place, day after day. You'll come to feel that your whole life swirls around this. This is the glowing core, the story behind the story. And then see how that core sends out its illumination into one's daily life, into one's interactions, making you more capable of patience and thankfulness and slowness of temper and thoughtfulness in all matters. Kind of easiness comes over you, a kind of loving kindness, united with, yes, the vigor of clarity and precision. All bubbling up from the luminosity of that daily communion with the Absolute. And stay together. Let's meet whenever we can. And meet with your fellow dervishes in your home, in the center nearby, in the region. Lend your hand to all undertakings for the service of this great work. And then this retreat will never end. It keeps going in all these different ways. And we'll gather anew in other places. And it's all of a piece. Ali mentioned Saluk. A new Saluk class is starting. And for those who haven't had the chance, I do welcome you, I encourage you, if you are ready and able to join the class, even though each of you has so much experience already. But Saluk is an intensive survey of the most fundamental esoteric teachings of the inner school of the Anayatiya, step by step, through concentration, contemplation, meditation, and realization. From breath and prayer to wazifa and zikr and fikr and qasab. All of these methods are taught incrementally. So I encourage you and also encourage you to send to Saluk those of your students who are ready for a deep immersion in the fundamentals. There's one more question, and then soon we'll go outside. Can you speak to how we can prepare ourselves as students of the heart to help humanity when the enormity of the ecological crisis is upon us? How can we soothe the panic, fear, despair that will come? How do we strengthen and prepare ourselves so that we may truly serve others in their fear and despair, truly to be alive right now is a great privilege, ennobling. How are religious leaders worldwide preparing? Pope Francis, of course, and many others speak directly. We of the heart must be wise and loving in this challenge. Please help us to move with love and peace, regardless of ecological outcome. There's a practice that Moshe taught to Shabbat's best, which is done in the movement of the form of the movement of the Zikr. And so it is the practice of the Zikr, actually, but one takes up a certain concentration. And that concentration is when you make the circle of the Zikr, you're tracing the circle of the planet, planet Earth. You're revolving around the planet. You're enwrapping the planet. So you do that as you say, La ilaha. And while you do that, you're no doubt aware, you perceive the state of the world and all of its tribulations and all of the changes occurring. Everything is visible. As you sweep across land and sea and sky, overlook the whole planet in its churning, in its in all of the transformations, all of the sufferings, all of the unravelings occurring. And then come down when you say illallahu, and as you come down you are evoking the tenderest, the sweetest, the most perfect loving kindness from the source of being. You know, prayers for rain are a practice maintained in many cultures. This is a kind of prayer for rain, but for the rain of Rahmah, that rain of the divine compassion that heals and enlightens and restores, revives, makes whole. And by maintaining this practice, one has an inner foundation from which to undertake whatever is your dharma outwardly in serving God's creation. So this practice is so that when undertaking outer action, one does so feeling and receiving the divine blessing and feeling the faithfulness that comes with that, in the absence of which there is terror and confusion and ultimately paralysis. But to act with the in alignment with the certainty of the divine Rahma, which has, after all, brought this very earth into being in the first place, that guides the heart. So we can do that. Shall we do that a few times? The alchemist Mary, the Jewess, said, from the one comes the two, from the two comes the three, and from the three comes the one. From the one being come. Mercury and sulfur, Purusha and Prakriti, spirit and matter, from the two come the threefold being of soul, mind, body, and from this three comes the remembrance and actualization of the One. And so comes autumn, when fruit ripens, fruit that contains the seed, trees of the seed, the tree puts forth branches, flowers, and fruit, and the fruit contains the seed. The fourth alchemical stage is called tincture. And the product is not gold. The product is the elixir, which turns metals to gold. So I want to tell you a story that Noor told, and that was her favorite of her own stories. She wrote it with the intention of planting a seed in the minds of young children, a seed that would grow all through their life, and that they would revisit at different ages and see in a new perspective. The manuscript is lost to us, but the outline of the story has come down thanks to Jean Overton Fuller, Noor's friend. And it tells of two children living in the Alps in Switzerland who notice how every night at sunset, a certain alpine peak lights up and glows the most remarkable color. That mountaintop is pure gold. And the children notice that there are some in the village who are very poor and struggling and suffering great hardship, and they think, if only they had this gold. So the children decide they will set off to win the gold and help their neighbors. So they climb and climb, and along the way they undergo adventures. They are entrusted with a secret, and afterward they are captured by villains who torture them to obtain the secret, but they refuse to divulge it despite their great suffering, and escape And because they have upheld their trust, they are guided by a fairy, and at last reach the mountaintop, where even the goats are gold. And the ground is gold. They dig out clumps, fill their pockets and sacks with it very happily. And then they descend down. But they notice as they are descending, the gold starts to fade. And before long, it's turned to mere dirt in their pockets. And they are saddened. What will they give to the needy ones in the village? They feel that all is lost. Until suddenly they have a realization. We cannot bring this gold to the ones who need it. But we can help them find it. And so we must become mountain guides. The end. Let's go to the ocean.